Thank you very much. It's very good to be here with you. Just before I begin, the handouts, I just wonder, because there's so many people, whether some people might not have got handouts. For this lecture, it's not very important, but the second lecture, you really need handouts. So I don't know if you need more, but make sure if you can that you've got the handout for the second lecture. Well, as you know, the series of lectures I've called the Gospels as Histories, and this first one is the Gospels as Historical Biography. But I want to begin by just a word about that word history, which we do actually use in a number of different ways, and it's worth just thinking that through. In English, the word history, has three meanings predominantly. And history can mean what happened in the past. It can also mean the study of what happened in the past. So that's, as it were, the academic subject, study history at university or whatever. We can call that history. But we can also mean literature about what happened in the past. You know, historians write history, and that's the literary phenomenon that, to be more precise, we can call historiography. I'll use that term also as I go on. And really in these lectures, it's that particular topic of historiography that I'm interested in. It's why I've given the lectures the overall title, The Gospels as Histories. Gospel as History is a good deal more ambiguous. Gospel as Histories, I hope, draws attention to my interest, which is not directly, though there are some, have some bearing on questions like whether the Gospels are reliable records of what happened, but primarily we're concerned with the question, what sort of historiography are they? The Gospels certainly are histories in some sense. Very few people doubt that. They purport to inform their readers about events that happened in the past. But what sort of history are they? And we must appreciate the fact that there's not just one way of writing history. There are a whole variety of ways of writing history. In the Greco-Roman world of antiquity, the kind of literary context in which the Gospels were written, there were various kinds of literature written about the past. A number of different kinds of literature written about the past. And in the modern world, as the academic discipline of history has developed over the last two centuries, there have also been different kinds of historiography. So in these lectures, what I want to do is to compare the Gospels with the sorts of historiography we can identify in other ancient literature to see where the Gospels should be placed, as it were, on the map of historical writing in their own time. And I shall also, rather more unusual task, I shall also be comparing the Gospels with some modern approaches to history, because I think this too can illuminate the character of the Gospels. It would, of course, be anachronistic to actually put the Gospels into a modern category of historiography, but I think that some modern approaches to history can actually work heuristically. In other words, they can open up for us aspects of the Gospels that we might not otherwise have noticed or paid much attention to. But for this first lecture, we stay in the ancient world. There are, I think, two books that must be foundational for any attempt to place the Gospels within the map of ancient historiography. Those of you who have got the handout, I think these are on page 2. The first is Richard Burridge's book, What Are the Gospels? A Comparison with Greco-Roman Biography, which was first published in 1992. It was one of the best-selling volumes in the monograph series that it appeared in, actually, and a second expanded edition appeared in 2004. It's a very influential book. The second book is by the Swedish New Testament scholar Samuel Biersko, and is entitled Story as History, History as Story. Unless I have that in front of me, I'm prone to put it the other way around. But it's story as history, history as story, the Gospels in the context of ancient oral history. And that was first published in 2000. Now, these two books take two rather different approaches to our question, what sort of history are the Gospels? Barrage relates the Gospels to ancient biography, whereas Bierzko relates them to ancient historiography, and whereas we could quite legitimately use the word historiography to include biography, the ancients actually tended to distinguish between biography and history. And I'll say a bit more about that later. So in a way, Barrage and Bierzko are directing us to different areas of ancient historical writing. But I think, as you'll see, I think they're actually both right. And they've laid the foundations on which I think any attempt to approach this topic must be based. So let's begin with Burridge. Now, for most of the 20th century, it was customary for the scholars to deny, often with considerable assurance, that the Gospels are biography. But it's now become common to maintain quite the opposite, that the literary genre of the Gospels is that of ancient biography. Now, it is important to say ancient biography, because scholars who take this view are not comparing the Gospels with modern biography, itself, of course, quite varied in character. The genre of the Gospels must be established from the study of ancient literature contemporary with the Gospels, and Burridge's argument is that they are and would have been recognised by their early readers as the kind of literature that the ancients usually called just lives, bioi in Greek, vitae in Latin. Burridge was not the first to argue that in the later part of the last century. A growing number of scholars had been making the same argument, but Burridge has made the most thorough and convincing study, and the results of Burridge's work have been very widely accepted, not universally, but very widely accepted by Gospel scholars. Burridge worked with a number of examples of Greek and Roman biographies, and he gathered a whole series of generic features that he argues are criteria for recognising the literary genre of bios biography. A work need not have all of these characteristics to belong to the genre, but it will have enough of them to be recognisable as a bios to those used to reading or hearing works of that kind. So just roughly the kind of things he looks at, there are opening features such as title, prologue, opening words. Then there are the subjects. I'm going to use the word biography for the person a biography is written about. Handy word even if I've invented it, I'm not sure. So the subject, which includes in Burridge's work the extent to which the biography is the major acting person throughout the work, and also allocation of space to various topics. And then he deals with external features such as the length of the work, its formal structure, and so forth. Now, clearly some of these features are more significant than others for recognising the genre. But the use of these criteria enables Burridge to conclude, I quote him, that a wide range of similarities have been discovered between the Gospels and Greco-Roman bioi. The differences are not sufficiently marked or significant to prevent the Gospels belonging to the genre of bios literature. The increasing tendency among New Testament scholars to refer to the Gospels as biographical is vindicated. Indeed, he says, the time has come to go on from use of the word, use of the adjective biographical, for the Gospels are bioi. Now, I'm not going to rehearse all his arguments, but really take Burridge's case for granted. But I'll just mention some points that he makes about the genre of ancient biography that I think are worth noting. And Burridge draws on general studies of literary genre by literary critics and so forth, and he stresses that genres develop and change. Genres, he says, are dynamic and flexible groupings whose boundaries and labels shift. So to follow up Burridge's argument, we don't have to suppose that there's nothing new about the Gospels. The Gospels may, I think, very plausibly represent a relatively novel development within the broad and flexible genre of ancient biography, which means that if people heard the Gospels read or read them for themselves for the first time, they'd think, ah, this is a biography, that's how they would identify it, but then they might discover that, you know, there are things about it that are not usual in biographies, and so it would come to be a sort of subgenre, but a special sort of subgenre. So we might still talk about the Gospel subgenre, but it's a development of the general category of biography. The other thing that's well worth noticing, so we'll come back to this, is that different genres of literature can influence each other. Burridge, quoting Alistair Fowler's work on theory of genres, speaks of multifarious extensions and interactions of genre. So the boundaries of a literary genre are not necessarily hard and fast. They can be quite flexible and porous. And this leads to the very important topic of the Latin term is genera proxima, neighbouring genres. In relation to a particular literary genre, there may be other genres that resemble it in some ways. And this close relationship can enable influence and borrowing from one genre to another. Of the ancient Greco-Roman period, Burridge writes that there was a lot of interplay and overlap between genres, particularly works on the edge of one genre and influenced by another. And again, he says, the boundary between bios and any of its genera proxima, neighbouring genres, are flexible. And so borrowing or sharing generic features across the border may be expected. And Burridge provides a map of the various kinds of literature that overlap biography, such as moral philosophy, novel, history, and encomium. The genres that specially overlap and influence bioi are encomium, which is a work written in praise of a particular person, and history, in the narrow sense that Greco-Roman writers tended to use. Usually when Greco-Roman people said history, they meant political history. And that's really why they distinguished history from biography. History is the history of nations and states and politicians and wars and all that kind of thing. Biography, of course, is the study of a particular person. So it's that particular relationship between biography and history that I want to dwell on a little bit. And it seems to me it's very interesting if we can establish that some biographies, not by any means necessarily all biographies, that some biographies come especially close to historiography, as Greek and Roman historians understood it. Now, really the strength of Burridge's demonstration that the Gospels belong to the ancient genre of biography lies in its generality. By showing that the genre was broad and flexible, Burridge makes room for the Gospels within it and shows that they are no different from some other examples of the genre than some of those other examples are from each other. It's a broad genre, rather different types of biography. The Gospels are not necessarily so much different, but they're different again. Now, Burridge scarcely attempts to go beyond this general conclusion to locate the Gospels more precisely within the diverse range of ancient biographies. Are they more like some of the ancient bioi we know than of others? Part of the difficulty in answering this question is that there really has not been produced a useful typology of ancient biographies. There's an old attempt to do this by Friedrich Leo, which was influential for a long time. Most people have now come to the conclusion that it's not at all a reliable way of categorising biographies in the ancient world, but we haven't really got a study that gives us a clear map of the kinds of biographies there were in the ancient world. Now, Burridge does, in a sentence, very briefly, offer three criteria that could define subgenres within the broad genre of bios. First of all, he refers to content, which may be either historical or philosophical, he says. He's thinking of biographies of philosophers that tell you a lot about their philosophical teaching. The content, there's structure, which may, he says, be either a chronological structure, what we most likely think of in a biography, simply tracing someone's life chronologically, but the arrangement of material could also be topical, so that's a possible distinction. And the third one, which I think is the most important, is the influence of neighbouring genres, which could make a biography, Burridge says, either historical or encomiastic. I think the possibilities here are greater than he notes. For example, many biographies have content that is neither historical nor philosophical, but literary. There are a lot of lives of poets and dramatists, literary persons, and as well as biographies influenced by historiography, there are also biographies that are strongly influenced by the genre of the novel or the entertaining story and overlap with that kind of fictional literature. Now, what I'm going to do now, in the absence of a clear typology of ancient biographies, is to introduce you to, I think, three ways in which we may distinguish between some biographies and others, and in the course of this I think we will come to see how the Gospels fit into this picture. Now, the first difference among biographies is an obvious one. They can be distinguished by the kinds of figures that they concern, rulers or generals or poets or philosophers or whatever. And there are perhaps two main types. There are political biographies, where the biography is a military commander or a politician or a lawgiver, something like that. All of the most famous ancient biographies, Plutarch, we have 50 of his biographies, and they're all of this kind. They're all political. They're all about rulers and generals and so forth. Secondly, there are intellectual biographies, and these are biographies of writers and thinkers, poets, philosophers, and so forth. These are often much shorter, largely because the people who wrote them didn't have much information about these figures. But people wanted it, rather like nowadays. You know, if people enjoyed the poetry or the plays or something, all the philosophy of a particular person, they wanted to read about their lives, and so writers had to supply such lives. Often they had to resort to a good deal of fiction in order to find something to say about ancient figures about whom very little was known. So those two categories, I think, cover a great deal of ancient biography, political and intellectual. Some people have proposed a third category, which is attractive if we're thinking about the Gospels, but actually much more difficult to identify. And that's a category of holy men. In other words, people who were not only wise teachers, like a philosopher, but also in a special relationship to the divine. And candidates for this include the life of Apollonius of Tyana, perhaps the work that is most like the Gospels in ancient literature. I'll say some more about that tomorrow. Or Porphyry's life of the philosopher Plotinus. He's more than just a philosopher. There's a degree of divine connection, as it were, going on in his life. and a few more, but they really add up to a motley crew. They are quite difficult, I think, to recognise as a distinct category. So I think trying to put the Gospels in this category is problematic. I'll just say that much to start with. Having made that distinction according to the type of person who is the biography, it is also, I think, worth noting that Burridge's argument doesn't require us to put Jesus into some existing category of sort of person in order for the Gospels to be biographies. In other words, in principle, biographies could be about just about anybody. So even if Jesus is a very unique sort of person, it doesn't mean that the Gospels are not biographies. Now, the second way I suggest that biographies can be categorised is by distinguishing between the lives of contemporary figures, contemporary at the time of writing, and non-contemporary figures. And effectively, this is to distinguish a category of lives of individuals with whom the biographer either had himself had personal contact, or at least about whom he had learned from people who did know that person well. And there were quite a number of biographies of this kind. Lucian's biography of the philosopher Demonax. He had studied with that man himself. Or Xenophon's life of Agesilaus, the Spartan king and general with whom Xenophon had served. Or Tacitus's life of Agricola, the Roman politician, who was Tacitus's own father-in-law. There are other examples of cases where the figure is within close living memory, as it were, and the biographer actually knew that person. Sometimes biographies were even written during the subject's lifetime, as Cornelius Nepos's life of his friend and patron Atticus was. And obviously also in this category belong autobiographies like that of the Jewish historian Josephus. So there's a category of contemporary biographies, if you like. But by contrast, of course, many biographies were written long after, even centuries after the biography's death. And the importance of making this distinction is that it corresponds to a distinction that ancient writers often make between contemporary and non-contemporary history. Non-contemporary history, history going far back behind the writer's time, was written, but it wasn't really esteemed like contemporary history, because in the case of contemporary history, the historian was expected to write on the basis of eyewitness testimony to the events, either his own or that of people he had personally met and had been able to interview about the events that he was writing. Good history in the ancient world rested on such immediate personal sources, much more than on written documents. And so by definition, good history, real history, had to be contemporary history, the history of events within living memory. Now, particularly in view of the closeness of historiography and biography as ancient literature, and the overlapping nature of the two, neighbouring genre, we should, I think, expect that that sort of judgment would also apply in the case of biographies. The writer of a contemporary biography would expect it surely to have had personal knowledge of his subject, or at least close contact with people who had known his subject. And the fact that some such biographies were at pains to point out that they had such eyewitness access to their subjects confirms that this is what was expected in antiquity. Now, the Gospels, just to note for the time being, the Gospels, almost everybody agrees, were written within living memory of Jesus. perhaps rather late in that period, but not accidentally, I think in my view, not accidentally at a time when there were eyewitnesses still available, still living, who could tell their own stories. So the Gospels, I think, on those grounds, qualify as contemporary biography. Now, my third criterion for classifying biographies is that close relationship between genera proxima, neighbouring genres. And for my purpose in these lectures, the important neighbouring genre is historiography. Now, some scholars have made a great deal of the difference between histories and biographies and insist on keeping them far apart when one thinks about what was expected to be done in a work of history or a biography. Now, historians and biographers did certainly have different perspectives on the important individuals who appear in both types of work. You can look at Plutarch's biographies, for example, all those politicians. Plutarch writes biographies of them. Other historians tell political history in which those individuals feature. But they do it rather differently, that the historian is concerned with the individual's role in the wider course of events, while the biographer may be interested in personal anecdotes, for example, which don't do much for the course of history, but they do illuminate the character of the person he's writing about. And Plutarch and others make that sort of distinction. Plutarch sometimes expressly apologizes, in a sense, for not telling you all the kinds of things about a figure that you might find in history, but telling you lots of more personal detail that he thinks biography is for. So, in that sense, biography and history could come quite close together. And the key point, I think, here is although the aims and content of biography may differ from those of history, and that's what some of the biographers say, these writers do not suggest that the method of the biographer, his access to and use of sources, should be different from that of the historian. And we can, I think, readily understand that biographers such as these could take what was regarded as best practice in historiography and take that also as the ideal for the biographer. Now, this close relationship between biography and history, as I've just suggested, would seem at first sight to apply only to political biography, only to the sort of figures of biography who are also key figures in the development of political and military affairs. But this is not, and this of course is necessarily the case, because history meant political history. And in fact, we'll attend to this again later, almost the only persons who appear as individuals in historiography are the movers and shakers of history, the politicians and the generals. This might seem to preclude the Gospels, whose subject is not a politician or a general, from being biographies close to historiography. Even though the life of a contemporary person such as a philosopher could not overlap in its subject matter with historiography, it would seem, however, that some of the ideals of practice, some of the ideals of historiographical practice did spread to other kinds of biography and not just political. So that's what I want to say for the moment about placing Gospels on the map of different sorts of biography. And at this point I want to introduce that second major book that I referred to, as foundational for this kind of work, and that's Samuel Bierskoe's book, Story as History, History as Story. Bierskoe compares the practice of Greco-Roman historians with the fairly recent modern historical discipline of oral history. And key element, I think, is that the role of eyewitness informants are very similar in the two cases. I've already noticed the fact that major Greco-Roman historians, people like Thucydides, Polybius, Tacitus, thought that real history could only be written while events were still within living memory. And they valued as their sources the oral reports of direct experience of the events by people who had been involved in the events. Ideally, the historian himself should have been a participant in the events he narrates, as, for example, Thucydides and Josephus and others were. But he could not have been present at all the events he narrates, or in all the places he describes, so historians also rely on other eyewitnesses, but eyewitnesses whom they could meet and talk to and get their information directly from. That was the ideal. Of course, not everybody lived up to the ideal, not everybody who wrote history lived up to those ideals, and Lucian, for example, has great fun critiquing all sorts of historians who clearly are not following best practice. But most would have employed oral traditions and written sources at least to supplement oral material. But the oral material was the key thing. And if historians really wanted to live up to the ideal, access to oral reports was pretty much essential. And some of the bad historians pretend that they have access to good sources, but that's sort of backhanded recognition of the fact that this was best practice. Now, a point that Bierskoe stresses is that for these Greek and Roman historians, the ideal eyewitness was not the dispassionate observer, but the person who participated in the events, someone who's close to the events, someone whose direct experience of what happened enabled them to not just report a few facts, but also to give a sense of the significance of what they had seen. The historian, says Bierskoe, preferred the eyewitness who was socially involved, or even better, had been actively participating in the events. Involvement, he says, was not an obstacle to a correct understanding of what they perceived as historical truth. It was rather the essential means to a correct understanding of what had really happened. And this is important because I think a lot of modern people tend to think that the sort of uninvolved, dispassionate observer will be the best witness. But ancient historians, and I think the authors of the Gospels as well, saw that you could get inside the events from participants in them in ways that you couldn't if you just relied on sort of people who happened to be around and happened to see what was happening. There's a coherence of fact and meaning, in other words. Eyewitnesses were able both to give a sort of empirical report of what anyone might have observed, but also a sort of engaged interpretation which came out of their involvement in the events. And the accounts of eyewitnesses became essential parts of the historian's writings. In this way, ancient historians' approach, the approach of ancient historians, bears quite close comparison with modern oral history. That's the analogy that Bierskoe exploits, I think, quite effectively. Oral historians today realize, on the one hand, that bare facts do not make history, and that the subjective aspects of an eyewitness's experience and memory are themselves evidence that the historian should not discard. While, on the other hand, modern oral historians are aware, very importantly, I think, that the person who's involved actually remembers much better than the disinterested observer. So they actually may get the facts a lot more carefully reported than those who just happen to be observing. So, in a way, the eyewitnesses' reports, with their mixture of, as it were, empirical facts and meaning, get taken over into ancient historians. And also, we have to remember that, of course, the Greek and Roman historians are themselves shaping their narrative. They themselves have their own elements of interpretation that they want to bring out in the way that they tell the story. So, having established the key role of eyewitness testimony in ancient biography, Abeascot argues that a similar role must have been played in the formation of the gospel traditions and the gospels themselves by individuals who were qualified to be both eyewitnesses and informants about the history of Jesus. He attempts to identify such eyewitnesses, to find traces of their testimony in the Gospels. He stresses that, like the historians, this material would not just be facts, but an interpretation of what was going on, a sense of its meaning from those who had experienced it and remembered it. The gospel narratives, he says, are syntheses of history and story. That's why his book is called Story as History. Synthesis of the oral history of an eyewitness and the interpretative and narrativizing procedures of an author. So, in Bierskog's account, the eyewitnesses to the events of Jesus' history do not disappear behind a long process of anonymous transmission and formation of Jesus' traditions by the Christian communities, as the very influential scholarly model of form criticism supposed in the 20th century. Rather, the eyewitnesses would have remained influential persons in the early Christian communities, people who could be consulted, who told their stories and whose oral accounts lay at no great distance from the textualized form that the Gospels then gave them. Now, Bierskog's work was one of the starting points for my own work on the Gospels and the eyewitnesses in my book, which you now all have seen, I think, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, the Gospels as Eyewitness Testimony. And in that book, I developed a thoroughgoing alternative to the dominant picture in 20th century scholarship of how the traditions about Jesus reached the evangelists and were incorporated in their Gospels. Developing Bierskog's model of ancient oral history, I proposed that the eyewitnesses of the history of Jesus remained throughout their lifetimes the accessible sources and the authoritative guarantors of the traditions that they themselves had formulated in the beginning when they first told their stories. And the Gospels were written during the period between the middle and the end of the first century, when the direct testimony of the eyewitnesses was still available but becoming unavailable as they died. So it was the right moment to write history based on the eyewitness testimony. And it's also a key component of my argument that the gospel traditions were not, for the most part, transmitted anonymously, as is usually assumed, but were associated with the eyewitnesses from whom they derived, especially the 12 apostles, but also some others. So in general, I've argued that the texts of the gospels as we have them are close to the way the eyewitnesses themselves told their stories, allowing, of course, for the shaping of the material by the evangelists themselves. In one case, I think, the case of the fourth gospel, the evangelist was himself the eyewitness, the main eyewitness source of his own material. But in the other cases, I think they are close to eyewitness testimony, if not themselves eyewitnesses. So a category of testimony, I think, is very important for our thinking about the Gospels, and I've developed that at some length in the book. But it's important to say that testimony is not a literary genre. So this isn't an alternative to the Gospels as biography. Testimony is not a literary genre. It certainly wasn't a literary genre in the ancient world. But testimony is a key part of the ancient genre of historiography. From what I've said already about the role of eyewitnesses and so forth in history and in the ancient world, clearly testimony is closely related to the practice of historiography. So we could say that the Gospels are biographies that are close to historiography, especially in the role they give to testimony. So I'm not going any further with the thesis I explore in the book. You can read that, or maybe some of you have already written it. But I've rehearsed the kind of main conclusions of the book because they do depend on comparing the Gospels with the practice of Greco-Roman historians. And so they relate quite closely to the argument of this lecture. But to return to genre, Biscoe is content to speak broadly about historiography and not to examine the differences between historiography and biography. Historiography in the strict sense in which the ancients often defined it. This, I think, need not bring Biscoe's argument into conflict with Burridge's, because I think we're in the area precisely of the overlapping of historiography and biography. And the fact that Biscoe can write a very illuminating book comparing the Gospels with ancient historians, historiography, and Burridge can do exactly the same for biography, I think confirms the idea that really Gospels are in there at the overlap of these two genres. And also the point that I've mentioned before, I think, is very important, that therefore historiographical practice, which is mostly what Biscoe is concerned with, how you wrote history, how you researched and wrote history in the ancient world, historiographical practice would very easily cross the boundary and be expected also of biographies, especially contemporary biographies, where eyewitness testimony is available. But let's go back again to what sort of biography is it? There have been various attempts, I've mentioned one or two of them, to specify what sort of biography. If we go for the sort of figure, if we try to distinguish by the kind of biography, and clearly this is a very significant aspect of how different biographies differ. Some people, I think, have been rather quick to think that biographies of philosophers are the closest analogy to the Gospels. Biographies of philosophers often give you quite a lot of information about the philosopher's teaching. They may even quote the philosopher's teachings in the way that the Gospels do. So at first sight, that's quite an appealing comparison. But I think the differences between the Gospels and philosophical biographies are quite significant. And it is much more plausible, I think, to see Jesus as a unique figure among the biographies of antiquity rather than associating the Gospels too closely with biographies of philosophers. And as I said, this is not a problem. Jesus could be a unique figure and you could write a biography about him. There's no problem there. If the archaeologists were to discover a papyrus copy of the life of an Olympic athlete, we don't have any of those, but there'd be no doubt it's a biography if one of those came up with, if someone came up with one of those. So a biography of a unique figure, such as Jesus, or a figure that's resembles other a variety of other figures, rather than being in a particular category, that kind of understanding of who Jesus was could still be easily accommodated within the genre of biography. Well now, let me now turn to some important features of the Gospels that we haven't yet considered and which tend not to be considered in the kind of discussion that I've pursued so far. And this section is called, the last main section of the lecture, it's called the Gospels as Biblical History. And the two aspects I want to talk about here are, first of all, Christology as a key element in the Gospels, and secondly, the relationship of the Gospels to the history that's narrated in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible. So, think first about Christology. Whatever various scholars might think of the historical Jesus, by the way, and I'm not concerned here with the historical Jesus, I'm concerned with the Jesus as he's portrayed in the Gospels. But whatever, therefore, scholars may think of the historical Jesus, in none of the Gospels is Jesus merely a wise teacher, or even merely a wise teacher who is especially close to the divine and can perform miracles. The Jesus of the Gospels is the Messiah, the Son of God. The Son of God, not a Son of God, as maybe the centurion in Mark's account of the crucifixion concludes, but the unique Son of God, who is the unique Messiah, the one who comes to implement the rule of God in Israel and in the world. Now, by identifying Jesus as the Messiah, the Gospels place their stories within a strong meta-narrative provided by the Old Testament, the grand narrative that runs through the Hebrew Bible from Genesis onwards. With the arrival of the Messiah, foretold by the prophets, this grand narrative, grand historical narrative of events in the Old Testament comes to a climax. So the Gospels understand themselves, I think, to be continuing and bringing to its climax the biblical history of God's purpose for Israel and the world. It's actually important to stress the fact that in the expectation of the Hebrew prophets, the future blessing of Israel was to be also salvation for the nations. It's an Israel-centered expectation, but it's also an expectation of salvation that will go out from Israel to the world. As the Messiah who fulfills this expectation, who comes to implement God's rule in its eschatological reality, Jesus is by definition unique, and also by definition of significance for the whole world. So in some sense, very, very important and central sense, the Gospels do present Jesus as a unique figure, and one who is relevant to all possible readers. Now, nothing resembling that could be said of any of the other individuals who are subjects of the other Greco-Roman biographies. Not even Alexander the Great, who perhaps comes closest to the kind of universal significance of the figure of Jesus. Therefore, some scholars conclude that really the genre of the Gospels should be sought in the Hebrew Bible rather than in Greco-Roman biography. And they would like to label the Gospels as sacred history or salvation history, something of that sort. But the Gospels are concentrated on the single man Jesus in a way that is otherwise only true of the biographies. It's difficult to escape Burridge's case at this point. There is nothing like that in the Hebrew Bible. Even when parts of the biblical history do focus for some time on a particular person, such as Abraham or Moses or David, they don't achieve that exclusive concentration on the one person that we find in the Gospels. Nor are the literary forms of the smaller units that compose the Gospels. Think about how the Gospels break down into units of a particular literary kind. There's not much like that either in the Old Testament history. And the reason for all this, I think, is that the Gospel writers wanted to write of the way that the biblical history had come to a climax in the story of this one man, the Messiah, the Son of God. The biblical story was now concentrated in this man's history, albeit a history with universal significance. And so the genre of biography, with its unique focus on a single individual, was precisely what they needed in order to tell the climax of the biblical story in the way that they believed that it had happened. So, if you like, these are biographies positioned as sequels to the biblical history of the Old Testament. And here I think we can come closer than we have on other grounds to what really distinguishes the Gospels from other types of biography. We could, I think, rethink that tendency of scholars to align the Gospels with philosophical biographies. Jesus does, of course, teach, but he's so much more than that. But actually, of course, as the Messiah, Jesus is a king, and all the Gospels stress that Jesus is a king. He is the king who is to reign in God's universal kingdom. Isn't that more like political biography, biographies of rulers, and so forth? Maybe we could see the Gospels as a kind of anti-political biography. I don't mean non-political, as though they had nothing to do with the political sphere. Very, very difficult, if not impossible, to separate religion and politics in the ancient world. But what I mean by an anti-political biography is that Jesus and the rule of God are presented as an alternative to the political system in which the subjects of the ancient political biographies, the strong men, the military men, the men who wielded power. Jesus is not a king in that sense. He's a different sort of king. So one might say that it's an anti-political biography, if that's what political means in the context. Now, just finally, let me illustrate how the Gospels present this perspective by looking at the way just two of the Gospels now begin. The ways the Gospels begin are very interesting and, of course, very important for readers. You begin to form quite strong ideas of what sort of thing you're reading by the opening sections of a book. Now, since both Matthew and Luke recount a story of the birth of Jesus near the beginning of their narratives, it would be especially clear to readers that these are biographies. But the beginnings of these Gospels also root their narratives in biblical history. Now, in Matthew's case, as you know, he begins with a genealogy. A very subtly composed genealogy, as Jewish genealogies often were, describing Jesus' descent from Abraham and from David. The genealogy shows Jesus to be both the Messiah for Jews, descended from David, and also the offspring of Abraham, the Messiah for Gentiles. The genealogy itself therefore introduces Jesus as a person of uniquely universal significance, presaging the Great Commission at the end of the Gospel, when Jesus sends out his disciples to all the nations. But Matthew's genealogy also functions in a way to resume the whole of the biblical history from Abraham onwards. Jewish readers who knew their Bibles, reading all those names in the genealogy, would be reminded of all the key developments in the biblical story of Israel. The names were not just names to them, they were figures in the biblical history. So in a way, Matthew's genealogy begins with a kind of summary of the biblical history thus far in the form of the genealogy. So Matthew's story of Jesus is well rooted in the biblical meta-narrative. But there is also, early in the story, a political dimension, even if that isn't already evoked by the genealogy, which of course, talking about Jesus' descent from David, already introduces some kind of political reference. But in Matthew's narrative, Jesus is scarcely born before we hear of King Herod and the Magi who come to him seeking a newborn king. And the narrative develops by way of ironic contrast between the two kings. Herod, on the one hand, in desperate fear of his possible rival, Jesus the king. And then in Luke's case, the continuity with the biblical history of the Old Testament is initially evoked by the kind of language that Luke uses in the first two chapters of his Gospel. Because Luke is a writer, a very competent writer of Greek, who varies his style according to its suitability for the subject matter. And here he uses a very biblical style, which almost subliminally works to place readers within the orbit of the Hebrew Bible. He also begins his story in the Jerusalem temple, the heart of the Jewish theocracy. But differently from Matthew, Luke is less interested in Herod than he is in Caesar. It was, so to speak, on the Emperor Augustus's orders that Jesus was born in Bethlehem, fulfilling the prophetic expectation and aligning Jesus with David, whose descendant he is. The link with Caesar, of course, is ironic. This child, born to a poor family, his birth announced to mere shepherds, contrasts radically with the man who wields ultimate power over most of the world. The contrast suggests that the messianic peace proclaimed by the angels to the shepherds contrasts with the famous Pax Romana, the boasted Roman peace that was maintained throughout the empire by military brutality. So in both these Gospels, Matthew and Luke, readers learn that Jesus is in a way an alternative king and an alternative kind of king. Quite a way before they learn that he is a wise teacher and miracle worker, as of course he turns out to be in a big way. Arguably, this puts these Gospels, I think, closer to ancient political biography than it does to philosophical biography. I don't want to press these things too far, but I think the resemblance to the political biography might well have been evoked in their readers by the way these Gospels begin. To sum up then, let me sum up 4 points of the argument of the lecture. First of all, in terms of ancient Greek or Roman genres of literature, the Gospels are biographies of Jesus. Secondly, since the Gospels were written within living memory of the history of Jesus, they would be expected to be based on eyewitness testimony. Thirdly, as biographies of Jesus the Messiah, the Gospels are also continuations of the biblical history of the Hebrew Bible. And finally, unlike any of the subjects of ancient biographies, Jesus is presented in the Gospels as a figure of fully universal significance. So I'll stop there, and I think it leaves us a few minutes for questions.
All right, the second lecture is going to begin at 2:30, and we're going to have a 15-minute break before that. So that means we have 10 minutes for questions, and we have a couple microphones up here. Let me just remind you that these should actually be questions. And brief. So we just have 10 minutes, so go ahead.
Since many of us are going to be pastors in here and we'll be dealing with people who aren't intellectuals and scholars and trained theologians, I was wondering if there's anything on this topic, because we're going to be dealing with, like, the lost that are going to be questioning these gospel narratives and the eyewitness accounts. Is there anything on a smaller scale that we can recommend to...
Oh, a book. To me.
Yes, a book. Articles, reviews, yes. of some sort?
Well, the argument of my Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, I have actually done in a very brief form in a Grove booklet. I don't think you know Grove booklets over here in the States very much, but they're produced. They're little books. It's about 28 pages. I think it's called The Gospels as Eyewitness Testimony, something like that. But if you can't get it any other way, try going on Amazon.co, British Amazon, or just try Grove Books in Google or something like that, and you'll find it's a very short summary, but I've found it's very useful. A lot of people say to me, "Well, I don't know quite whether I want to read the book. Can I manage that?" And I say, "Well, you know, read the short Grove booklet first, and then you might be interested enough to want to read the book." And some people do that. Other people are quite content with what they've learnt from the. It's kind of, you know, the argument of Jesus and the eyewitnesses in one lecture, basically. So that's the most obvious thing. I'm going to be collaborating with someone else on a small book. I mean, a real book, maybe 100, 150 pages, which will also be a more accessible version of the big book. The other thing I would recommend, actually, has a very strange title which puts people off. It's called The Jesus Legend. And it's by two people who are Paul Eddy. And sorry, I just forget the other, but you'll find it, I think, under Paul Eddy, E-D-D-Y. It's called The Jesus Legend, and the subtitle is something like an argument for the historical reliability of the gospel traditions or something like that. And it's a fair-sized book, but it is written, I guess, probably with a wider readership in view than my one. And I mean, they're very, you know, the two mesh doesn't have the same arguments as I do, but they're quite coherent, you know, with what I'm saying. It's a good book, I think. So that might help. Okay.
Yes, sir. I have not read your book that you've been speaking on, but I wonder what sort of bearing does this work, or what sort of category would you put the book of Acts in, seeing that is sort of a sequel to Luke's own gospel?
Yes, yes. I think there'd be a very wide agreement, I think, that Acts is a historical monograph. I mean, sometimes people have tried to say it's a biography of Paul. It doesn't really work. I mean, there's so much before you get to Paul, and there's so much about Paul after it stops, in a way, you know. So I don't think it's plausibly biographical. I think it has to be an ancient monograph. And David Orney, who discusses literary genre of the Gospels, comes to the very odd conclusion, therefore, that the three Gospels other than Luke are biographies. But Luke, because of its connection with Acts, must be categorized as historiography. Whereas if you're just looking to the Gospels, I mean, there's nothing really in that sense to distinguish Luke from Matthew or Mark in particular. I think the key to this is probably what I was saying about the way that historiography and biography were so close together. So that it probably would not be too anomalous for people to think, well, you've got a historical biography and then the story is continued by a historical monograph. And I think that's how I would have to put it. And again, I think it's determined by what Luke wants to do. You know, he wants to tell you about the great climax of biblical history in the one person, Jesus, which requires a biography. But then how Jesus' story was continued, of course, in a sense, it's more of Jesus' story in that he's directing it from heaven. I think the way to do that is to write history. So I think once you think about what Luke's trying to do, the difference of genre is intelligible.
Dr. Bachum, how do modern studies of memory relate to our study of ancient documents? For example, Dale Allison has appealed to that and specifically is more skeptical than you are with regard to the Gospels.
Yes. I haven't yet caught up with what Dale Allison is writing about this. At least I read a very brief presentation of what he thinks, but I haven't read the big book, so I'm not really entirely into what he thinks, but I'll make a comment. I mean, I have got a whole chapter in Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, which is based on, I mean, the very large literature there now is of psychological study of personal memory, eyewitness memory. I mean, it's very important to say that eyewitness memory, or the memory of things that you have done or that have happened to you yourself, is a very special category of memory. It's quite different from remembering a report or remembering what was in a book or something. You're remembering your own experience, and that has its own sort of features. And so I read actually quite a lot of this, and when I wrote the book, it was very up-to-date stuff. And one of the things I tried to do was to draw out of that the kind of events that are remembered best, and how people who remember are most likely to remember accurately. So things like, actually, if you're involved in an event, you're more likely to remember it well. If it's an event of big significance to you, you're much more likely to remember it well. Things like that. There are a series of, you know, the kind of events you remember best. And the other thing is, the more you rehearse a memory, the better you remember it, as it were. So, you know, if you don't think about anything for 40 years and then you try and remember your childhood or something, you won't remember it anything like as well as if you told people about it very soon after it happened. And what happens, if you think about this, I think it's true, that what happens is that the first time you tell someone a story of what's happened, it begins to acquire a fixed form in your telling of it. You know, and probably 20 years later, you're still telling it in much the same form, structure, and so on. And that helps you. Now, I envisage the gospel eyewitnesses not as people who, you know, in the years 70, you know, sat back and tried to remember their memories of Jesus. I envisage them, you know, from the beginning, they were telling these stories, which are so important to them. So they're rehearsing them all the time, and that's aid to memory. I mean, none of this, of course, is a sort of guarantee against remembering things badly. I mean, you know, it's only human that we do remember things badly. But I think the gospel material qualifies pretty well as the sort of stuff that people are likely to remember accurately. The one thing I did pick up from Dale Allison, which seems to be very, very questionable, and I don't know whether he had any scientific evidence to back it up. It's more a matter of personal anecdote. He says that you remember generalities about people better than you remember particular stories. Makes quite a lot of this, I think. So you remember that your aged aunt was a kind person. You don't necessarily remember, you know, the particular visit you made to her a year before she died or something like that. And that seems to me, and again, I don't know whether the scientific... I'd be surprised if there's scientific evidence to back that. It doesn't seem to me to be true to experience. I mean, I think I remember people mostly by remembering particular incidents that stuck in my mind. So, you know, you remember the last time you saw your aunt before she died because she was important to you, you know, and it seemed very significant that you spent that time with her. I think the things that stick in your memory are very often particular incidents rather than the generalities. But I'd have to read his big book to know quite how he argues that, and therefore how I would disagree with him in any more detail. But I do stress that, you know, my argument in that chapter of the book was based on a whole lot of recent psychological study, and I actually had it checked by a really quite eminent psychologist who, you know, he could find no fault with it. He said, you know, that's absolutely right. That's my authority for saying what I say.